I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 2008. The album is Fred Dagon. And let me learn to use the words. anthology. The artist, John Clark, and my guest is Rhys Darby. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, you obviously didn't go out of your way to shock me, but I like being surprised. This is going to be my first comedy album from this region of the world. So, I'm assuming you grew up with this. This goes back to your earliest memories. This sounds like that kind of, it's old enough.
Yeah, definitely.
Because this is an anthology of albums from the 70s.
Yeah. So, Fred Dagg, which is the character he played, mm-hmm. John Clark is the comedian or satirist, actor, writer, many things, I guess. But back then, we're looking around 1973, 74. Mm-hmm. This character he created, which was the quintessential New Zealand farmer, mm-hmm. Fred Dagg. Dagg, of course, I don't know whether you know what that means, mm-hmm. but it's with a sheep, a dag is the dried bit of poo that's hanging off their bum. They're called dags. So we have this saying in New Zealand called rattle your dags, which means hurry up. So that's, and Fred is the classic, you know, that's the name. So Fred Dagg is his character. This is obviously, I was born in 74. So, mm-hmm. I found out about him many years later, but he's been an iconic character in New Zealand for that long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what's your first exposure to him? Well, I know he was a bit on TV, but I didn't get to do full research.
Yeah.
So
for me, it would have been, I think probably seeing him first, mm-hmm. seeing the piece he did with Country Calendar. Now, mm-hmm. Country Calendar is a very rural New Zealand show. I think it's our longest running show. I think mm-hmm. it's still running.
Okay.
So it's basically a documentary series about rural life in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And each week they would... The presenter would be in some part of New Zealand and just talking casually to a farmer about what's going on in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did, what John Clark did with his Fred Dagg character was he did a parody. So it was like a 25-minute, one version of one episode of Country Calendar was about him. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was completely dried, very serious, but the stuff he was saying was ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
including all his, I think, seven sons called Trevor and various, yeah. And really, so that was sort of seeing that. And for me, it was so ahead of its time because, well, like I said, we're talking about, you know, mid-70s, and he's creating this kind of humor that we would later see in things like The Office,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it was very ahead of its time. And I think what I love about him, first of all, is why I chose him for this, is because it is quintessential New Zealand. He's only really known in New Zealand and Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And, I could have chosen so many vinyl comedy records for this thing, particularly the Monty Python stuff, which
sure.
I grew up with. But I thought, you know, I'll choose this guy because he means a lot. And he shaped particularly myself and Jermaine, who, you know, I worked with in the Concords, was very much into his style as well. And I think there's something about that rural intellectual
mm-hmm.
that I don't know, kind of speaks for New Zealanders.
Yeah.
Because we are, you know, trapped in a paradise millions of miles from anyone.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But we still like to think and we still like to have our opinion.
Sure.
But no one's listening. So, you know, I think that's where it all comes from.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where I'm going to go ahead and say my ignorance is going to shine through because you speak to some people, for instance, okay, and I'm going to completely forget his name. biggest French comedian, stand-up comedian, whose name is, oh my God. Either way, it's
Marcel Marceau.
Yeah, there we go. Marcel Marceau. Brilliant stand-up. But France didn't have stand-up until this guy 20 years ago.
Right.
And so my expectations, I don't know what to expect of New Zealand. I know that New Zealand's going to have access to all kinds of, because, you know, I mean, but, you know, what, within the last 15 years, it's people just have known it as Peter Jackson's Private Island. That's basically, so, you know, you don't get any exposure to the only comedy I knew from New Zealand is yourself and the Flight of the Conchords guys, you know?
Yeah. And we came from John Clark's sort of, beginnings. And then when he did this kind of stuff, it's satire. It's very dry. His style was, there was no set up punchlines, actually, hearing what you've heard from the album. It's just the way he speaks, and it's very, it's almost as if you were listening from another room, you're listening, you could hear through, and you would think that you were listening to you know, some sort of documentarian or a political speaker.
Absolutely.
It's not until you go into that actual room and listen more carefully that he's for want of a better word, just talking bollocks, you know. And so, and I think it's that style where it's, and a lot of it is stream of consciousness, and a lot of it is improvised. And when you think about that, you think, wow, that he's got a very fast mind, and he's just spinning words at you.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're looking at this guy dressed in a black singlet. He's got wearing, you know, gum boots, which are, I guess you call them rain boots over here, but they're what we wear on farms. And it's kind of, and it's important because it means that, wherever you are in the world, you too are just as important as someone who's, you know, running a business in New York or whatever. I mean, you may be spending a lot of the day picking up sheep poo and opening gates, but you have a voice, and you may, and this is a parody of it with Fred Dagg, but you may be able to solve problems.
Yeah.
World problems, big problems.
And for lack of a better word, there's so much heart in that, because that's not a thing you find over here as much. I think if you were to take your typical comedian, maybe, and they were to take a rural character from anywhere in this country, you know, I'm from a pretty rural part of upstate New York, immediately becomes a caricature, and you're making fun of the way they speak, and their supposed intellect, where at the very least you like you described, you've got this place that is everybody's kind of coalescing, so you're going to have these fascinating combinations that's much more human in terms of the experience it's reflecting.
And we're all linked very much, very closely in New Zealand. There's a 2 degrees of separation, as they say. So, you know, if you're not a farmer yourself, your friend definitely is. Or he knows one. So therefore, there's less of that distance hick kind of thing that you have here in the States, where, you know, oh, he's so far away, that the redneck or whatever, and because he's doing whatever is way out there. And less of that vast space. Of course, in Australia there would be, because it's very vast, but New Zealand, it's just two little tiny islands. And you know, you're never more than an hour from the coast.
So when you it also reminds me, of course, of Short Poppies, which was delightful, which was so much fun to watch.
Thank you.
And again, the same kind of heart. I don't know how, but it is a complicated thing to mix. Again, I keep saying heart. It's the only word I can think of right now. But sincerity with genuine satire. Like, you're clearly satirizing. He's clearly satirizing New Zealand, while at the same time, there's a lot of love.
Yeah. So when I did Short Poppies was definitely off the back of him doing his Fred Dagg character on this Country Calendar documentary. And so I thought, what if I could do the same thing, but do, you know, various characters and have a reporter? Because if we look at the footage of the original Fred Dagg being interviewed on Country Calendar, there was a reporter there. There was a guy standing there, and a real reporter, and following him around as he showed him around the farm, and and his crazy inventions that he was making and you know, out of trash and things. And I thought, well, what I just adored it. And and I thought if I could do a collection of characters and their lives could intertwine, and they lived in a small town, and a reporter just so happened to go out there in the same way and find random people in a small town and make it as real as possible, then that would be a real treat. And also fun to pull off and difficult to pull off, because just the whole keeping of the straight face. Because a lot of it, and with Short Poppies too, was improvised, and David Farrier's sitting there and just, to his credit, is not laughing. On occasion he would, of course, but and I wanted to expand the world slightly. Rather than just have a series of long form interviews, I wanted to have a few little narratives and plots that that are happening and amongst it to give it that series appeal. But yeah, that was you can see the definite inspiration I had from him.
It's a beautiful day for this time of the year, I do believe. Not a cloud in the sky. We're just waiting for the 1976 handicap for fleas to get underway. This is a race run by fleas. The fleas will be running around about this area of the stage. You will not be able to see them, but I shall be recording it all for you in minute detail. We've got some of the classiest fleas in the country here today, and the classiest of those fleas would be Big Hero. Big Hero by Pride out of all proportion. And Big Hero would be the favourite, but there's another flea that we shall be watching very carefully in this race. Another flea, and that flea is Daggy Boy. Daggy Boy by jumping one night out of Trevor's sock. Daggy Boy is not expected to run very well, but I've got quite some number of zillions stacked on the nasal organ of Daggy Boy, and I shall be very disappointed, not to mention bankrupt, if Daggy Boy does not come in the victorious position.
Now, was this something that you shared with your family? I'm assuming, since you saw it on TV, or no?
With Fred Dagg?
Uh-huh.
Yes, well, yeah, everyone that I knew of him.
Mm-hmm.
And his comedy, and then his stuff on vinyl as well, and he was quite famous for his songs. Mm-hmm. So in particular, We Don't Know How Lucky We Are, mm-hmm. which is kind of a New Zealand anthem, really, because, and it still stands today, on the idea that the rest of the world is going through a lot of stuff, and we're on this little island and don't know how lucky we've got it, mm-hmm. to be born in this place. So yeah, that one, and then there's the Gumboot song. There's a few other sort of bits and pieces. Now, when he left New Zealand, I think, I want to say that around the 80s,
mm-hmm.
went to Australia and never really returned. And then at that time, and so let's look at the 80s. I mean, I was sort of, that was my era.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a kid growing up at that point. And the other comedians we had, I guess, at that point, we certainly had his stuff still, because it was recorded and we would see it and hear it quite often. But then there was Billy T. James, which is the other New Zealand comedian, mm-hmm. who was also a huge icon back home. And he was singer, songwriter, sketch, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
Maori as well, so okay. Became very iconic. And he was on television. He had his own TV show, which also to use the term take the piss, take the Mickey, take the piss, mm-hmm. out of who we are.
Yeah,
and it became a thing, because with John Clark and then with Billy T. James, and these are sort of both sides of the coin. You've got your white farmer, you've got your Maori worker,
mm-hmm.
Entertainer. It was okay. It became our New Zealand thing to take the Mickey out of who we are, because mm-hmm. we realized we do know how lucky we are. We're in this amazing country that is plentiful of food and we have a wonderful agriculture and products and we're surviving very well. And so our humor then became to take the Mickey out of who we are as people,
mm-hmm.
because we're so isolated.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but but I think that's the basis of where you see a Flight of the Conchords.
Sure.
You know, when people watch that show, they went, "Why are you guys so?" I mean, you're taking the major mick out of who you are as people, because you know Murray Hewitt was just an absolute idiot, you know, and he's the cultural attaché, and the posters on his wall and his 1970s computer, you know, and then you've got these two cool looking idiots who are the Conchords, who are supposed to be a popular band, who's you know being led by someone who knows nothing about band management, and yet. This is our humor, and we really, really enjoyed it. And the New Zealander, and we actually were worried a little bit there, because even that back home, they would go, "How dare you portray us in this way?" You know, such being such fools. But they didn't. They loved it, and they realized, you know, the whole thing is a big joke, and we're the ones laughing at the end of the day because we managed to get a show on HBO in the wonderful America, and it's a huge, huge deal. So, you can see how it all comes back to the 70s and with Fred.
And that's the exciting thing to me is, and I want to get to the fake sport on here in a second because it kind of ties in with it. New Zealand is such a young country. But comedy, so therefore. It's probably easier, I would imagine, to track the history of comedy in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Very easy.
So that's what's so friggin' great about it to me, as like a kind of an archivist, and I'd never call myself an archaeologist, but I am interested in the history of comedy.
Right.
Before this character, what's your experience or knowledge of New Zealand comedy before this?
Before Fred Day?
Yeah.
Oh, nothing.
See, this is what's blowing my mind a little bit. Because I would imagine if anybody would know, it would be yourself.
No. No, I don't know if it goes back any further.
Yeah. Well, I just want to know
There's definitely got to be something happening in the 60s, I guess. And, you know, I know that Billy T. James goes back quite far as well. And then there's certainly been others since then. And during then, you know, I could mention many, the top twins, MacPhail and Gadsby, they were very political satire. So all their material was built around the politics of our country.
Mm-hmm.
But going back even further, I mean, I really think it was definitely, because we're very strongly British, definitely back in the 60s. And so all of our comedy would have come across from the BBC, would have been radio, BBC radio stuff. And I know that that's what inspired John Clarke initially as well, with the way that he would be very, very wordy with his comedy. Because it would have definitely been radio based at the start. So yeah, other than that, there would have definitely been just all round entertainers like touring some of the working men's clubs with guitar and song. And I know that's what Billy T. James did too at the start.
Yeah.
And then probably said a few old man's jokes in between, you know, that kind of thing. but yeah, I think the comedy explosion really happened. I don't want to say it was me and the gang, but I think it definitely happened later in terms of stand-up and stuff like that happening. Mike King, I'm just rattling off names now that won't mean anything to people, but when you look at it, well, at least listeners on this side of the world, but I would say the first comedy club, which opened up in Auckland, called The Classic, which used to be a porn theatre, opened, I think, I'm not sure what the date was now, but around about 1995.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me in, Jana. It's a very great pleasure to be here.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not Yana.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong place.
No, this is a current affair, I'm not Yana.
I see. Oh, well, thank you very much, not Yana, for inviting me in. It's a very great pleasure.
That's fine. You're having a dispute with Greenpeace over your exploration off the coast.
Well, yes, there is some ground between us yet to cover. The precise detail, you see, of what we're doing seismically is somewhat at odds with the general principles espoused by Greenpeace. General principles, I might say, which we also espouse, the espousal of which would be axiomatic, I would think, to any understanding of environmental issues.
Yeah. Could you be more specific?
Yes, we were going to dig a dirty great hole in the seabed because there's a quid in it and we got caught and we're rather embarrassed about it.
What do Greenpeace say is wrong with what you're doing?
They say the area we want to dig up is a whale breeding area.
Is it?
No, it's not.
It isn't?
No. Well, that is to say it won't be.
Well, when won't it be?
Well, it won't be when the whales get out of the area, will it?
Well, where are the whales going to go?
I don't know. I don't even know there are any whales there.
Isn't it a breeding ground, though?
I've never seen any whales breeding out there.
Well, have you been out there?
Of course I've been out there. I was out there the other day.
On a whale spotting boat?
No, on a dirty, great, big new drilling rig we've got that can displace an area the size of India in an hour and a half. Fantastic thing.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was actually shocked because I had a gentleman named Rich Scheidner on here. Amazing guy. Wonderful. Has a great history with comedy. He's been in it for 40 years, and he was there for basically the first comedy club like that guys were going to in the 70s, and that hurt my brain because before that guys were just going to diners and stuff, you know, like or nightclubs or whatever, but strictly comedy clubs started in the 70s. That hurt my brain. I guess I'm actually surprised then I'm very surprised that the 90s is the earliest that you're going to see that in New Zealand. God, that's mind-blowing a little bit to me.
Yeah, and I think it harks back to, for a long time, we never really had the confidence with comedy because it was, what we received was mainly British, and then there was also American stuff coming through, definitely with television.
Sure.
So we absorbed, I would say, the best of the British and the best of American sitcoms.
Yeah.
And we struggled to, apart from some of those names I've mentioned, come up with what our own humor would be.
Yeah.
And also we have a tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand, which is where that TV show Short Poppies comes from, because the tall poppy syndrome, have you heard of that? That's where...
I've heard you talk about it, and I've completely forgotten.
Okay, so,
about, so I apologize.
Tall poppy syndrome is when you stick your head out, you get it cut off.
Okay, like, okay. All right.
So therefore, we have a small population, and I think if anyone starts to sort of wave their head about and look at me and be confident, then the rest of the people will go, hey, calm down, mate, calm down. Who do you think you are?
Yep.
And they slice you off because it's that kind of rural mentality of, you know, stop showing off, mate, 100%. Get back into the shed and milk the cows like the rest of us, and we'll all play rugby and then, you know. And so that was felt, and I think that's gone now. But, well, I feel like it's not completely gone, but it's definitely diminished. And I really tried to make that diminish.
Yeah.
Because I felt it when I would come back. And that's not so long ago, 2009, you know. Once again, I've gone off track.
That is a sign of me as an interviewer, not you as an interviewee. Do not worry. Yeah. No, but I completely understand that feeling, too, being from a rural area. But again, I also had a lot of fucking options. I got to just go to Chicago. You know?
Right.
I got to just go to Chicago and see if there were options. When culturally, just entirely culturally, it's like, no, don't try.
Yeah, don't get up. Don't say, you know. And there wasn't even really too many places to get up and tell jokes.
Yeah.
And so once the club started opening up and, you know, the floodgates were open, people could try stuff out. And then slowly over time, we got a confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was once the Concords TV show hit America, and then we almost immediately realized that's what our comedy is. We love taking the mickey out of ourselves because we do it with a straight face, and we do it so well that the audience are baffled as to whether this is really what we're like, or is he that funny? And for years, even when I, with the Murray Hewitt thing, I would go anywhere and people would be absolutely shocked that I'm not dressed like him. or that I, you know, or like I've got some hip clothing on or whatever, and they go, "Well, you got a stylist?" Or you know, "No, this is what I'm like." And so, they really believed that, you know, I was that guy. Holy and shit. And they love that guy, and which is great, and I love that guy too. But I'm not gonna rock a goatee, you know, for 12 months of the year. But anyway,
I guess my question is in this. In such a small community in general, like just as a culture, how do you know that it's an option to do comedy then if that's the prevailing theme?
Yeah. And I think it, well, I love to say that it comes naturally to those that should be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up, my mum, she had a great sense of humor. My dad as well. They weren't together with me as I grew up. I only had mum, but both parents were pretty funny. Mm-hmm. And mum in particular, who brought me up, every day she saw the lighter side of things. Mm-hmm. And didn't take anything very seriously, and I think that's a little bit of a detriment to me, because I never take anything seriously. So I, you know, if I didn't marry the right person, I'd be living under a bridge right now, owing so much money to so many people. But thank God I did well there and married the right person, and I'm in control. Well, she's in control, but I. But anyway, and so I think I didn't even start off. You know, thinking I was going to be a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the army straight after school. I thought I was going to be a soldier. For some reason, I thought I should be dropped in behind enemy lines and rescue POWs or something. I mean, I think I watched too many war films. Uh-huh. And I was late to mature, and I didn't really know what I was supposed to be. I ended up leaving the army and going to university then to try and find what it was I was going to be. And I thought perhaps a journalist, because I liked English mm-hmm. as a subject, and I was fairly good at writing. Thank God it was university that threw in my face the idea that it should be comedy that I should be doing, because there was a comedy club. You know how universities have clubs and
sure.
societies, and,
sure.
and a chap named Guy Roberts signed me up. He saw, I think it was the way I was walking. He said, "Come over here. Do you want to join the comedy club?" And I did. And it was a bunch of like-minded people that met once a week and wrote sketches and stuff.
That's
and all
great.
Of a sudden, I found my thing. And I realized, this is what I should be doing. I've been laughed at my whole life.
Uh-huh.
And I like, I'm the class clown. I like making people laugh. But I never thought of it as a vocation, mm-hmm. especially not in New Zealand, because we didn't have we didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have the comedy clubs, or, you know, there was only a few people that were known for doing it. And even though I loved comedy, and I was obsessed all the way through that point with Monty Python and BBC comedy, for me, it was probably, in my mind, the other, you know, and I wouldn't be able to be that. So it was when I started doing it at university and actually being involved in some of the and the sketches, and we put on an annual show, the Capping Review, and I got huge applause by going out and doing something on stage. And I say huge, you know, it was probably wasn't huge, but I'm looking back I enjoyed it,
yeah.
and realized, I am good at this. But still then the next problem was, you know, how am I going to... So I just decided it would be a hobby. And then carried on and did other jobs. And then slowly the hobby took over. And at that very same time, we started getting television. We got a stand-up show on TV okay. where they would recruit young comics. And so there was... there was certain things happening, and then I'm just telling you my life story now. And then it happens. Go to Edinburgh and do the Fringe in Edinburgh, and then the rest is history.
Yeah. Wow. Is there for you? I mean, because I guess this is the part I did not get to to John Clark's biography, was what you told me is him just basically going to Australia, and that's kind of the end of it. I mean, did his comedy then become, I assume, no longer about being a New Zealander? I assume. No.
He kept it going.
Okay.
He kept the New Zealand thing going. And also
would the same like feel? Was it? Is,
yeah,
is, okay,
yeah. And then
right.
he worked with other people and then sort of integrated into the Australian society.
Mm-hmm.
Kept the same style going, okay. and worked on various projects in Australia, and decided to remain there. And you know, there's all sorts of rumors about him being scared of flying and never wanting to return because he didn't want to get in a plane. But I don't know whether that's true or not.
Uh-huh.
I just think he found a good thing in Australia, and I wonder. I mean, there's some of it could have been the tall poppy situation or something. I know for what he was doing in New Zealand, it was quite ahead of its time, and I don't know whether I'm assuming that he was getting a few no's to progressing and mm-hmm. where he should have gone, like for example getting his own show or something. And
I think
the television there, probably the heads who are, you know, I'm pretty sure that the same people running it now are so old-fashioned. They just don't get that comedy changes. And that I think he was probably denied a few options and so thought, well, I'm going to the big country next door.
Yeah.
And I think doors opened there for him and he remained and is still there now, still doing the same great stuff.
Have you ever thought about Hamlet? I wouldn't bother if I were you. I don't know what all the fuss is about. It's a load of rubbish. I think the guy who wrote it actually is dead now, but if he wasn't, I think he'd be in big trouble for plot stealing. Exactly the same thing happened up our way a few years back when Norm Davison knocked his brother Herb off and married Herb's old Sheila, big Brunhilde by the name of Trudy. Now this son of his, Trev, came back one year and got a bit toey about the lack of his old bloke, and all the dogs were running for Norm and one thing and another, so he decided to approach Norm about it and have a bit of a chat and blow his head off. But Trev was a bit short in the decision-making department, and he played her out for months, thinking about it and talking to himself about the pros and cons of dispatching Norm into the land of Nod, and by the time he got round to it, the whole district was involved. His girlfriend couldn't handle it at all. Matter of fact, she fell in the river and bit the dust, as I remember. A brother tried to plant Trev, and there was a bit of a mix-up there, and they both ended up making the ultimate sacrifice. And then Trudy, I understand, got food poisoning and bit the dust, and just before he died, Trev actually did get even with Norm. I was up there, as a matter of fact, the day they were cleaning the place up. I never saw such a mess in all my life. And Barry Fortinbrough, who was a stock agent and a bit of a ratbag, he got 47,000 acres and all the wool he could eat. So if you ever see Hamlet, remember that it happened here in New Zealand first.
Like I said, you had me listen to an anthology, so I got to listen to a ton. More than I usually get to listen to for one episode.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no. That was fun. It was so much. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, every time I think that I can navigate an accent I'm unfamiliar with, there are times when I got completely lost.
Right.
You know, everyone, slang mostly is what throws you. Even if I know what the word is, I get a little thrown.
And
that's
he makes up a lot of his...
Oh, yeah.
He's got a way with words.
That I love. That reminded me so much of... And again, this is 15 years before Stephen Fry, but it reminded me a lot of the stuff Stephen Fry used to do.
Right, yeah.
On A Bit of Fry and Laurie. And just that kind of... The garbage mouth.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But with such confidence, like you say, and such dryness. Yeah. It's just so...
No time... There's no room to laugh as well. It's just,
keeps going. Yeah.
Yeah. And then so it's... You just enjoy it. It's like jumping on a ride and just listening to the lyrics.
Mm.
Yeah, and the way it's said.
Although there is one part that genuinely threw me for a loop and I did laugh out loud at, which was him talking about, and I'm assuming it was the Dag character, because it's not all him, right? It's just, it's him occasionally. He's doing different characters.
Yeah.
But I assume it was that character talking about philosophy and saying that ennui was French for Henry.
That's right. Yeah,
he just kept saying pulling a Henry, which is one of the fucking funniest things I've ever heard. And I kind of feel like should enter everybody's lexicon for when people have ennui, pulling a Henry. It's fucking delightful. And there's just so much. I mean, I don't know. I can tell you at least my favorite part, actually, oddly, was there's a whole Parliament bit, which is all about whether or not they should be broadcasting Parliament meetings. Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's one of my favorite parts in this. Do you have a favorite sketch on this or of all time of his?
Where's the, do you have the list?
Yeah, let me pull up the track list. Absolutely, it is right here.
I know there's a lot on there.
There is a lot, but there you are.
Okay, well, there's a few things I really love. the flea race because because I was inspired by this and my comedy. I was in a duo with a guy called Grant Lobbin, mm-hmm. and he does a similar bit where the flea race piece in this is commentary given from a commentator at the races. So it's that style of racing this time when he's going around the outside, and you know, and to keep that up for one thing is quite the trick. But then to obviously instead of horses it's fleas, mm-hmm. and then when the other fleas come around the outside to beat the flea that he wants to win, which is Daggy Boy, he just stomps on them. So yeah, I love that one because of the way he keeps up the commentary. Mm-hmm. I also love if you have a look at this earlier stuff here, the 21st speech, because it's a classic New Zealand kind of guy. We have this sort of a man's man kind of male, rural male, really having a lot to say about someone but literally saying nothing about them. So, and it's that you have to give a speech, you've got nothing about the guy and you just ramble. And that was sort of I think that's like one of the first tracks on
here.
Yes,
it is.
And so you kind of figure that you see what he's good at, which is just rambling and hearing his own voice. And the other one I really like, let me see. Oh, well, there's so many here. If you look at some of the later ones where he's working with his partner,
mm-hmm.
and they are, yeah.
There are a lot of great interviews that are of, if I'm not mistaken, government personalities or officials of some kind.
He's being interviewed as a politician.
Yes.
Right. Talking about, one of them is the environment one on here. Is that on here?
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about, protecting the environment. And also the one that follows it, which is the front fell off about an oil tanker out at sea. And he would have made an amazing politician.
Yeah.
Because he's just got the gift of talking to you, making you believe that, you know, it's all, I think I've accidentally played it there.
You're right. At least my headphones are on.
Yeah. But he's telling you, he's giving you nothing.
Yeah.
And it's the art of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty prevalent in this day and age when you look at what the current political climate here.
Of course.
About how, you know, when in particular, obviously, our president, when he's asked questions, he certainly doesn't have the art of conversation
to
get around it. But,
yeah.
You know, you need to be able to sound intellectual, tap into the idea of the question.
Sure.
And just dance around it in such a magical way whereby, you know, the person who has asked the question is ends up walking away satisfied. It's not probably till 20 minutes after he's caught the bus home where he's thinking, hang on, that wasn't even an answer, you know? And I think that's a real gift.
Yeah.
And I created a comedy character that was inspired by Fred Dagg, which is a ranger called Bill Napier.
Mm-hmm.
And I've played him quite often, where I dress up as a park ranger and I come out on stage and I do a deeper voice than I normally have, which I enjoy because I get so sick of my own voice. So it's nice to have a deeper one, a more manly. I'd like to play a manly man. And he is inspired by Fred Dagg because he is a rural man, and he talks the talk as well. So it's a similar, it certainly by no means has the sort of intellectual and lyrical kind of poetic follow throughs that mm-hmm. he has, but he does have the same, as you say before, heart.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's that kind of, you have empathy for these people because you give them the time of day.
Yes.
And I think that is so important in comedy, and I think I've done that with most of my characters, is you'll listen to them and you won't automatically, you know how when you meet someone within 30 seconds you might go, oh, I don't like this person. And I don't want to give anyone ever that option. I think you need to be likable to be loved and,
yep.
and to be laughed at, and it's okay to be laughed at as long as people are walking away liking you,
right?
You know,
and
I don't think some of the people in our current political climate have that.
I would absolutely
yeah. They're laughed at, but they're not. Yeah, they're not kind of. Oh, he's adorable.
Right. Yeah. You don't get that anymore.
They're all horrible.
I wonder if that was our ignorance before this, and we just missed it the whole time. But it's very hard to say.
A new wave of pricks.
Okay. So were these albums sitting? Did you have the albums in the house growing up?
I think I had one of them. Mm-hmm. My brother had. I have an older brother. He's 9 years older than me, and he. He had quite a lot of LPs, and I inherited them.
Okay.
And so I had, I think it was Fred Dagg's Greatest Hits, mm-hmm. it was called. And that was, I think that was in like a 1974 album. And so that would have been some of the stuff from this anthology would have been on there. And I think it probably had We Don't Know How Lucky We Are.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was just injected into the psyche of New Zealanders that... He even just that one song, just dropping that song and then heading off, and then we all would have gone, yeah, you're right. And then of course now he's gone.
I'm moving
to Australia. but it meant a lot. And I think, like we've already talked about, his style of comedy certainly wasn't the here's a joke coming at you right now, there's your punchline.
Uh-huh.
It was the stream of consciousness, and to enjoy someone's ramblings, almost mad ramblings.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't know that I was mostly going to be getting, at least towards the beginning of this anthology, mostly like monologue style stuff.
Yeah,
and I really like it actually, because it's not easy to be compelling that way at all.
No,
stand-up's one thing where you either get to tell a story or play a character in a certain way, but he is quite distinctly talking at you.
Yes.
You know?
And at the end, some of the later tracks, which are with, I think, Brian Dow or Dow, whoever his Australian partner is,
mm-hmm.
you get the two. So you get, which are a series of sort of interviews where you get more back and forth. So instead of it just being a monologue, he's getting questioned, and then he's thinking on his feet, trying to as a whatever politician he's playing, trying to solve the current situation that's he's got no hope of solving.
Good evening. Australian farnarkling received a much needed shot in the arm with the news that Australia have eliminated Sweden in a nip and tuck affair in sub-zero temperatures at the all-weather farnarkling centre in Gothenburg earlier today Australian time. Dave Sorensen, the dith prawn of Australian farnarkling, was prominent throughout and set Australia up with a powerhouse display in an explosive third warble. The axiomatic Sorensen, who was cleared to play only moments before the flange was lowered, was all over the opposition until unfortunately a spring went in his knee and he lost all feeling in the hormones. Sorensen is now in doubt for the semi-final against either Scotland or Taiwan, and it'll be tragic indeed if they can't unscrew him before the weekend. A result now, just in from Queensland, race 5 at the Bunga Grandon Jockey Club's meeting at Win a Heap of Bucks. 7, thank you kindly. 2, no trouble at all. And 8, failed to turn up. There will be no third dividend. Number 3 was scratched. Number 14 was very badly scratched. Number 11 was severely lacerated when he fell out of the mobile barrier. And the favourite, number 4, stayed in the mobile barrier singing Danny Boy and asking what the horses in the back room would have.
I feel like I kind of feel like you're lucky that this is the guy that happened when he did, because if I think about, because I'm doing this thing where I'm listening to, because I got so many comedy albums, I'm listening to one a day for the whole year,
right,
just to burn through them. And some of that involves listening to some local comedians from the 50s and 60s, like from all around the country.
Wow.
And it's mostly shit.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's this, you know, guy doing stand-up that stands out, but not just that me listening to it now, 40 years later, that I still genuinely find it funny, like that says a whole lot to his skill. And again, how lucky New Zealand is that they got this as their guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And We Don't Know How Lucky We Are.
Right. Perfect. We should end it there, except I got to keep you for at least, I don't have to keep you. But I do want to ask, what. So let's talk about some of your other influences, because you did talk about Python. Mm. What English stuff were you getting, and, well, British stuff in general, but what American stuff were you getting as well?
Well, I'm a funny one, because I didn't really collect comedy albums. Mm-hmm. I didn't really, I mean, I certainly had an infatuation with Monty Python, watching their shows, mm-hmm. And then buying their, I would have been cassette tapes at that point, like,
sure.
And mostly the Monty Python Sings, which is all of their musical numbers. I think that was a double cassette, with the big tongue on it.
Mm-hmm.
Loved that. And then I think I started to try and basically collect everything that they ever did. But I wouldn't have been, it was the 80s. So I wouldn't have been really a vinyl situation. Would have been probably be a lot of stuff on cassette tapes, which is, I wish those things never, ever happened. But, and I have no idea what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I have since bought all this stuff on vinyl. Now I have it all on vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So it was them. And then I guess from this side of the pond, I've always been Steve Martin,
mm-hmm.
Fan. But didn't purchase anything. You remember I joined the army when I was 18, or actually 17. So I got straight out of school. I was a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no time for collecting comedy albums.
First, of course,
I was defending my country. But and I think, and then I was a big Jim Carrey fan.
Mm-hmm.
So also, yeah, I guess one for one on each side of the Atlantic. Really, for me, it was like also Rowan Atkinson.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a big Blackadder fan.
Sure.
And the Young Ones, Rick Mayall, and then I listened to a bit of Bill Cosby back mm-hmm. in the day as well. So I'm just trying to go from back and forth from the different sides. So those were kind of the things I was into. Oh, of course, Eddie Murphy,
mm-hmm.
Raw and Delirious. Just by seeing them, just that was probably the first time I realized that, hang on, can stand-ups be cool?
Right,
you know, I think a lot of people probably felt that too. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, the red leather. I mean, but then, you know, but he is who he is. And, you know, it doesn't mean that I could be cool at that point. But I was definitely a big fan of Spike Milligan.
Uh-huh.
I have to bring him into the fray. So you'd know all about him and the Goons. Peter Sellers, of course, who then went on to really be my kind of major inspiration for my acting and things like that. And I guess, yeah, what I'm trying to say is it was certainly character-based actor-style comedies, not so much stand-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, although I do stand-up, it is very theatrical and character-based and physical.
Yeah.
So, that's probably, I'm a result of watching a lot of, theatrical style silliness as opposed to a guy behind a mic telling you how it is.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, so I'm definitely in the other pool. And so therefore, on my own doing stand-up, and I had the duo as well with Grant, it was always, silly recreations of scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing prop heavy. We didn't, might have the odd thing, but not really. It wasn't so much reliant on that, but certainly or costumes for that matter. It was always just we would shape our bodies in a different way and put on different voices,
mm-hmm.
and I would do sound effects and things. And then when I went solo, I kept doing that, and so that's still what I do today. So it's kind of ended up being, something that if you haven't seen me perform, it is probably a little different to anything you would have seen, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when you said Steve Martin, that kind of lit a bulb off, because which is not a phrase that anybody's ever said, lit a bulb off. Fuck me.
Well, I went with it.
But yeah, thank you very much for that. But that immediately made me think that's probably what I could closest equate your comedy to. Even it's, whoa, what was that?
Yeah,
noise?
I
Sorry, there's just a loud scream of something.
This neighborhood, since IKEA has moved in, I'm telling you, it's going off the charts. There's murders, kitsets.
But you've got this thing where you're not afraid to make the character of you on stage look stupid.
Yeah.
And people, by the way, I think a lot of comics say that, you know, you have to be willing to be the butt of the joke. I don't think most of them are.
No.
I don't think it's as common. People will say that as a thing you do. Mm. But I think you genuinely do it.
Oh, yeah. I love, and I think maybe you have to have extreme confidence to be able to then really take the piss out of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In various scenes, in various ways. And I believe it too, and I know that in real life, you know, I can be a complete klutz and an idiot.
Sure.
But for the most part, I'm not. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I do hold it together. I'm a normal guy, and sometimes I even do some good things. But when I, you know, but I'm quite capable of slapsticky silliness just in real life.
Yeah.
And finding myself in situations where I'm, you know, either getting chucked out of a bar like I was the other night, or you know, just lost and confused in some sort of department store and having to get help. You know, these things happen to me, and
of course.
So you know, I'm not afraid to recreate those scenes on stage. And I think it's because, you know, once you get more successful and you realize, look, it's okay. You know, I'm now 42. I've made it this far in my life. I'm going to enjoy, you know, telling people some of the stuff that's happened to me so that they can have a really great laugh and enjoy their Saturday night.
Yeah. Well, and that's, it's a very weird, it's an in-between Steve Martin and I guess you're like a Louis C.K. who likes to, he'll apparently tell very real stories on it.
Right.
But you will tell that with a twist.
Yes, and I do, know? Yeah, and you know, it's not all true.
Sure.
And you can tell when, you know, I'm clearly going off into the realms of fantasy,
uh-huh.
like where there's a mermaid involved or a jetpack, or, you know, I'm ejecting an odd-looking woman out of my car. You know, these things didn't happen, but in my mind, you know, they did.
Sure.
And so you can take it all with a grain of salt. And, you know, I have a new show coming up, which is another collection of stories of things that have happened to me or may not have happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And usually some of it has. And, mm-hmm. and then I just extend it to, well, in my old days when I started doing stand up, I would tell these stories and I thought, well, they've got to have an ending. I used to end most of my stories with some sort of explosion. So one story was I was about me trying to put the seatbelt on in a taxi. And you know how these seatbelts, sometimes they just don't quite go.
Mm-hmm.
They get halfway down and they keep locking. You know, you've got to sort of try and caress it and try mm-hmm. and pull it on a certain angle. So, and meanwhile, you know, with half an hour into the taxi drive and I'm still trying to get this thing on. And this was the whole story, was just this epic journey of me trying to get the seatbelt. And in the end, I think I wound down the window and leapt out or something, and the car hurtled into a superstore and just blew up. And, you know, clearly that didn't happen, but uh-huh. in my mind, you know, that's where things were heading. And so I have a big artistic license to be able to, I think, just the result of having a big imagination.
Yeah.
And it's I've been called a little cartoony sometimes and stuff, but yeah, that's, I think it's just fun. You know?
Well, and again, it takes skill to be able to be that cartoony and also keep it dry and seemingly real and that you believe it.
Yeah.
That of course makes you come across as insane and that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. So if you were going to recommend this anthology or any of his albums to somebody who's never heard it before, as I had not until today, how do you condense why to listen to his material?
Why listen to it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think it's important to, first of all, see where the root of comedy came from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have certainly made a little bit of a stamp on the world market now,
mm-hmm.
Through some of the things I've done with the Concords and with Taika and some of the movies he's making. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about New Zealand humor that people are going, oh, yeah, that's different again. Because it's not, it is definitely, has elements of British and American,
mm-hmm.
But it has a very, a an innocent and a very heartfelt rural beat to it.
Yeah.
And if you want to know where all that came from, then I think this is the guy, and you'll be able to see it by listening to this album. And also that we do love to stand up and be confident and improvise, even though we come from a country where certainly, definitely back in the 70s and through right up until just recently, we were stopping ourselves from doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he moved to Australia. I moved away as well. I moved to America. I have since returned many times, of course, and always will. But we need to get to a point where we're comfortable with our humour in our own country. And I think we're finally getting there now. We've got some really great young comedians who are doing the same kind of comedy, but in a country where we're all kind of happy with ourselves now. And it's the whole young country thing, like you mentioned. As we're getting older, I felt like New Zealand is a teenager now, you know, and it's not a cocky teenager, and I don't think, hopefully it never will be, that's Australia, but a teenager that certainly has talent and knows it.
Yeah.
And I think we're there now. And this guy knew it in the 70s. Yeah. So I think he's pretty special.
It's nice to be able to have pride in what you do and what your whole country does.
Like, yeah.
That's fantastic. I'm only pulling up my phone here because I want to tell you when this episode's coming out, unless it needs to come out sooner. But do you have anything to promote?
No, only
this is going to come out March 15th, unless you need it earlier.
Okay, yeah, no, I'll be in Fiji then, filming Wrecked Season 2.
Oh my God, all right.
TBS.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tour, I'm doing a New Zealand tour of stand-up with my new show. So that is July, August. So
wow,
this would be lovely to mention that, so
yeah,
we can get all the comedy fans, who I'm sure will come to my show anyway, but I think that guy's, you know, he's past it now. You know, he's... Well, then listen to this, and you'll know where it all comes from and how much John Clark's always meant to me. And then when I hit the rural towns, I'm doing 18... I was going to say cities, but small villages in New Zealand this year. So my biggest tour I've done. I normally do a tour every couple of years, so it's been 3 years since the last one. I'm really looking forward to doing these, going back to my roots and my small town places in New Zealand, and doing exactly this.
Yeah. And I should point out, you make a delightful turn on Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Oh, thank you.
As Don Johnson's boyfriend.
I know.
To point out, it's fucking amazing.
His
holy
little bitch.
Crap, that blew my mind. That was just...
so weird, right?
It's weird, but friggin' great.
Yeah.
It was perfect. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
This has been a ton of fun.
It was a pleasure.
I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, you know, we were going to talk about the fake sport on here. I'm just going to say, listen to the album. I did a documentary about a fake sport. That's the next thing I'm going to promote.
Oh, cool.
Go to bit.ly/SoapTownDVD. I got a movie called Lords of Soaptown. It's about a sport that started out as fake and became real. And it was a prank, and then it became a real thing. And then it's a crazy movie. Go see that. I'm listening to a comedy album a day. If you go to youtube.com/comedyonvinyl, I'm reviewing them mostly day by day. I'm a few days behind, but you can forgive me at this point. Well, that is about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Thank you guys for listening to this week's episode. I wanted to also remind everybody that last week's guest, Eddie Schmidt, who produced my favorite documentary of all time, Beauty is Embarrassing, also executive produced a new movie that's coming out called Gilbert. It's the Gilbert Gottfried documentary, and it's directed by Neil Berkeley, who also directed Beauty is Embarrassing. So the Tribeca Film Festival announced the premiere of it, which is going to be April 20th. So if you're going to the Tribeca Film Festival, based on the team, based on Beauty is Embarrassing, which is, again, the greatest documentary I've ever seen, you need to go see it. And also, if you heard Eddie Schmidt on the show, you know that he's a great comedy lover. He's worth supporting, right? Go check it out. Thank you guys for listening.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.